Welcome back to Vashon 250, episode 29, Valley Forge. In this episode, we'll discuss Valley Forge, the Pennsylvania encampment where George Washington transformed the Continental Army into a disciplined fighting force despite harsh conditions in the 1777-1778 winter. Bruce and I are joined by our good friend Nancy Bristow, and we will take on the importance of Valley Forge over the next 30 minutes. Valley Forge is located about 18 to 22 miles, call it 20 for round numbers, northwest of Philadelphia. It served as the winter quarters for approximately 12,000 Continental Army officers from December 19, 1777 to June 19, 1778 during the American Revolutionary War.
It's interesting to think about Valley Forge just 20 miles away from Philadelphia. This is a time when the British have occupied Philadelphia. You know, we think 20 minutes, man, on the freeway, that would take you, if you're staying at speed limit, less than half an hour. But during revolutionary times and the winter, you know, I mean, you didn't have roads, you didn't have telegraph, you didn't have telephones, you didn't have any kind of communications other than somebody, a horseback rider. You know, 20 miles is a huge distance in 1877, 78. But in our minds, you know, if you visit Philadelphia and in Independence Hall and you drive to Valley Forge, you think, man, it's just right around the corner. But in reality, it's not.
Well, the other part of this is if you think about 12,000 Continental Army troops, our little island here of Vashon is, what, 11,000?
Mm-hmm.
And by the time the Continental Army went through that winter, and we'll talk more about this here in a second, they lost 2,000 members due to disease, dysentery, lack of food, what have you. And so we're talking about our own little burg here, and some just in terms of numbers. That's kind of interesting. So with that, following the defeats at the battles of Brandywine and Germantown and the British occupation of Philadelphia, Washington chose Valley Forge for its defensible terrain, proximity to supply sources, and strategic location to monitor British movements. The winter was difficult, but not the coldest of the war. Soldiers faced shortages of clothing, shoes, and food, and some enduring days without meat and many listed as unfit for duty due to inadequate clothing. Disease, including influenza, typhus, and dysentery, claimed nearly 2,000 lives, making illness a greater threat than cold or starvation. Despite these hardships, the Army constructed 1,500 to 2,000 log huts, miles of trenches, fortifications, and a bridge over the Schuylkill River, creating a structured encampment resembling a small city. And again, thinking through the numbers, the encampment was just slightly larger than Vashon Island in terms of population. After losing about 15% of its people, Valley Forge was indeed about the population of our island.
One of the key outcomes of Valley Forge encampment was the professionalization of the Continental Army. Under Washington's leadership and with the assistance of a former Prussian officer, Baron Friedrich Wilhelm von Steuben, soldiers received rigorous training in drills, weapon handling, and battlefield tactics. Von Steuben introduced standardized military procedures and hygiene practices, which improved discipline, cohesion, and combat readiness. Washington enjoyed support among enlisted soldiers, but some commissioned officers and congressional officers were not as enthusiastic. During the winter encampment at Valley Forge, Washington's distractors attacked his leadership ability in both private correspondence and in public publications. Ultimately, Washington's reputation improved and he prevailed as commander. This training prepared the Army for future engagements, including the Battle of Monmouth in June 1778.
Now, Valley Forge was home to a diverse population, including soldiers from all 13 colonies, women, children, free and enslaved African Americans, indigenous allies, and European immigrants. The encampment demonstrated the resilience, cooperation, and determination of the Continental Army and its supporters, becoming a symbol of American perseverance and patriotism.
It's interesting to me when you go through that list is how much it is like America today. I mean, America at its very beginning was a polyglot culture. It was not one thing. You know, and we often think of, well, these were all British colonists. Well, they were, but they weren't. And so there's that continuity in terms of what America is as a diverse, polyglot sort of cultural country. We've never been one thing, and Valley Forge is a great representation of that.
It really is. And today, Valley Forge is preserved as Valley Forge National Historical Park. It encompasses about 3,500, 3,600 acres with restored structures, reconstructed log huts, memorials, and museums. It commemorates the sacrifices and achievements of the Continental Army and serves as a site for education, reflection, and historical interpretation. The encampment of Valley Forge is widely regarded as a turning point in the Revolutionary War, where the Army emerged stronger, more disciplined, and capable of securing American independence.
And there are numerous events over the next 250 years of American history that echo the difficulties, challenges, and the low points that Valley Forge represented during the American Revolution. So, Bruce, walk us through what some of those historic events might be.
Well, there's a few wartime events that sort of represent a nadir, if you will, or a low point in a war. And, of course, in the Civil War, one of the very first battles at Bull Run is essentially a major defeat for the Union. I mean, lots of records of congressional members driving out in their carriages to watch this glorious victory that's going to occur at this battlefield in Northern Virginia, just miles away from Washington, D.C., and it's an utter rout of the Union Army. It's always been a surprise that the Confederate forces didn't follow up and invade D.C. at that time, because the Union Army was on the run. But it really was an awareness for the first time by the Union and by government officials that this war was not going to be won in a few days, that this was going to be a protracted conflict. And it did. It turned into almost a five-year conflict that really decimated populations of young men in particular, both North and South. So there are examples, but also Pearl Harbor, the beginning of World War II. I mean, the American Pacific Fleet is basically destroyed. The one saving grace is that the aircraft carrier task force is out to sea, and no one really foresaw that aircraft carriers would become the key to victory in the Pacific. And so it was just fortuitous. The battleship fleet that the American Navy was built on, that the Japanese Navy was built around, although the Japanese understood the emerging power of aircraft in naval warfare, left America reeling. I mean, FDR's famous sort of proclamation, this is a day that will live in infamy. America was on its heels. And what happened as a result of that, in some sense, is that America was forced with the decision. They were already engaged with the war in Europe, not as a belligerent yet, but certainly with Lend-Lease, certainly with providing destroyers to the British and protecting convoys already in the Atlantic. And so the Atlantic War was basically already beginning for America. The Pacific War began with Pearl Harbor, and America was at a turning point. Where do we put our resources? And of course, we decided to focus on Europe, fight a delaying action in the Pacific. And then only later in the war were we able to begin sort of a march, the island hopping campaign to reach Japan. So there have been instances in the past where America has been on its heels, if you will.
And just as an aside, if anybody are listening happens to be in Honolulu, it is very worthwhile to take the Pearl Harbor tour. There's several tours. You can go to the Aircraft Museum and all that. But the actual one for the one for December 7th is extremely well presented and tells the story of what led up to the day, how the day unfolded, and then culminates with the explosion aboard the USS Arizona. But the way it's presented, they've done a fabulous job, and it's well worth the time to do it. go early because there will be a line to get in.
Another great example to me has always been during the Vietnam War, the Tet Offensive. I mean, America had been fed a sort of line of propaganda, essentially, that the Pentagon Papers finally sort of opened up, but that we were winning this war, you know, that the body counts were coming in, you know, it was just sort of like, it was just a matter of time before America would win the war in Vietnam. And the Tet Offensive was just kind of a slap in the face of reality, saying, wait a minute. This war is not only are you not winning it, you're actually losing it. And although the Tet Offensive itself was a military defeat for the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, in reality, it reshaped the war and it reshaped American attitudes about the war. So going back to this original concept of Valley Forge and these sort of low points in American history and American warfare, there have been a number of them.
One of the things that's really interesting to me is that this notion of low points being followed by a kind of resilience and creativity is something that we see, as you suggest, with after Bull Run and the creation of, you know, it takes time, but the creation, right, of a very victorious Union force, Pearl Harbor, and then, you know, have to be very tactical and strategic, but ultimately, you know, an American victory in that war. The Tet Offensive is so different because, in fact, that helps to lead to the ending of the war in a way that is not a victory, obviously. But again, this idea of sort of creativity following the low points and resilience is something that we see throughout American history, not just at the sort of military circumstances or military events, but among the citizenry in all kinds of ways. An example for me that is really powerful is we think of the post-Civil War era and the end of Reconstruction and the imposition of the Jim Crow system of sharecropping, disenfranchisement, you know, the loss of the right to vote, racial segregation in all kinds of public and private institutions, leading, to, of course, to totally unequal circumstances and access and racial violence as well. So you have this, what I would call a low point. In fact, a famous historian refers to it as, quote, the nadir of Black life, meaning the ultimate low point. If you can call something that is not the period of enslavement a nadir, it's clearly a very low point. But we see incredible creativity and fighting back out of the Black community. You have everything from the anti-lynching activism, Ida B. Wells being the most famous of the activists, but many people involved in the anti-lynching effort. We have the Colored Alliance of Farmers, a national organization to organize sharecroppers. It's sort of, in theory, a brother to what will become the populist movement, but always sort of pushed to the side by the white activists, but very active among Black farmers. Washerwomen in Atlanta, right? They actually strike. This is like really hard labor, very heavily underpaid, very heavily exploited. In 1888, the Black women of Atlanta organize a strike and win. So again, this sort of finding a way out of no way is something that's both a national tendency, but I think very much a citizen response as well. And again, we think of the Black community organizing legally as well. So all of those cases that lead to the Brown decision in 1954, that doesn't start in 1954. Even that case itself is the bringing together of multiple cases that had been brought by parents who just wanted something better for their children. And the NAACP then picks up those cases. And then you even have in sort of more social cultural ways. You think of the Harlem Renaissance and the emergence of all this remarkable African-American art, from theater to music to poetry. Again and again and again, we see the creative responses and beautiful creation of art out of the context of a really tough time in American life. So again, we see a kind of citizenry that's also capable of organizing together and rising up in the midst of the lowest points and doing it in ways that show not only a strength, but a real creativity it's pretty special, I think.
And Nancy, since you are the resident expert on pandemics, at least amongst the three of us sitting here, the 1918 flu pandemic in response, you can speak to that, but I'm just curious to know what kind of outcome came as a result of that. They did not have social media, TV, all the media stuff that we have today, which certainly shaped our view of it. But what did we learn any lessons from 1918?
We did. We just didn't apply them very effectively. There's a lot of data now coming from 1918 that helped to inform a lot of the choices that were made in 2020. But in the intervening years, we did not choose to create a healthcare system that would actually protect and provide access to all Americans. Canada, alternatively, decides to do that in the wake of the 1918 pandemic, recognizing that having a more nationalized approach to illness is very handy. Viruses don't care very much about county lines or state lines, let alone national lines. And so in some places, you saw a real effort to think through what had happened and to organize in a larger scale in anticipation of what would come, you know, what would be the next one to come down the pipe. Because we did see in 1918 a really effective organizing that at the time they couldn't see so clearly really did have an impact on lowering death rates. So the implementation of the kinds of protections that we used, we drew from 1918 based on data that showed that cities that had an early response, a sustained response, and an enforced response had much lower death rates than those cities that did not, or those states that did not. So a place like Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that had a pre-existing public health system that was pretty strong, had a much lower rate than, say, Philadelphia, we like to pick on. In some ways, it's not their fault because it came so quickly to Philadelphia. But again, they were slow to respond. They went ahead and held super spreader events, and they had much higher death rates as a result of the pandemic. So it was in some ways parallel to our own experiences in the sense that the power sits at the local level, not at the federal level, but there was a lot of ideas coming from the federal government. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting, John, in response to your point about social media, is that they were able to get the information out. We think, oh, it was the dark ages. They didn't have the capacity to share information. Well, they did. They actually had these things called newspapers. And people read them.
And some of us still read them.
But it was very, very effective. So like the Public Health Service was putting out pamphlets. Remember our conversation about the Thomas Paine pamphlets? They used pamphlets published in multiple languages, because we're a nation of immigrants, to access public health information for all. They used the schools to share information. But as a result, people in very small towns like Vashon Island could learn about what was happening in D.C. or Pennsylvania, what was happening in Denver. They were following the war, but they were also following the pandemic on their own front pages.
Thanks. Bruce, let's talk Great Depression.
Well, the Great Depression is another one of those sort of nadir points for the American economy and for many American citizens. You know, a third of the nation is unemployed. And what you get as a response to that is FDR's New Deal, which, you know, echoes what Nancy talked about, is sort of the creativity and sort of the responsiveness and the ability to innovate. We look back at the New Deal, and it was sort of many people at the time classified it as sort of an alphabet agency, because mm-hmm. they had the NRA and the WPA and the PWA and the CCC, and the list goes on and on and on. But it was in effect that attempt by Roosevelt and the Democrats to just try anything to see if it would work, versus what had happened in the late 20s and early 30s, where there was virtually no response to the emerging depression. And so, yeah, it's one of those instances in which American innovation, American ability to sort of try things, that sort of American pragmatism, if you will, that sort of like, we'll try it. If it doesn't work, we'll throw it out and try something else, becomes a sort of a hallmark of the New Deal during the Great Depression. And if you look at our society today, many of the basic structures of the society today come out of the New Deal. You know, I mean, the recognition of labor unions, the recognition of the role of the federal government, even though that's contested right now, but certainly out of the New Deal and in the end of the 50s and 60s, it becomes clear that the federal government has a responsibility for the welfare of people. the beginnings of Social Security, the beginnings of what would ultimately become Medicare and Medicaid and things like that, all trace back to the Great Depression and to the New Deal. And also many of the agricultural policies that we have go right back to the original formation of the Agricultural Adjustment Administration.
And one of the things that's really special about the Great Depression era, in my mind, is that you have that combination of the federal government acting, but often acting as a result of pushing coming from citizen activists again. So you have, right, that labor policy is the result very much of complete disruption of the American economy, and activists, whether it's the sit-down strikes in Detroit or any other number of ways in which labor unions are organizing during that period, that pushes Roosevelt then to make law that actually supports those kinds of actions or frees them up. Similarly, you get the creation of the CIO, right, as a result of all of that. The other thing that's interesting is you have the rent strikes, right, in New York City. So people who are really in desperate circumstances who aren't yet helped by the New Deal will take it on themselves then to create some sort of response as well.
So let's jump ahead now to current events. As we always say, we live in interesting times right now. And I'll open it up to both of you. What are some of the most significant events in our, say, last 5 or 6 years that find some root in the experience of Valley Forge?
Well, we can talk a little bit more in just a minute about COVID and the response to COVID on Vashon and in Washington State. But one of the things that strikes me, I just heard a talk by the governor, Ferguson, just a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about this concept of innovation. What do you do when you're confronted with a breakdown of traditional sort of structures? And he was talking specifically about the appointment of RFK as Secretary of Health and sort of the decimation of the CDC and all these sort of protocols and practices and guidelines that are put out by the federal government that have disappeared. And what he did, along with the governor of California and the governor of Oregon, is they formed a West Coast Health Alliance. They created their own CDC. And then Hawaii, the governor of Hawaii was so enhanced by it that he asked to join as well. He's a medical doctor himself, asked if Hawaii could join this West Coast Health Alliance. And what they're doing is they've created a state-based CDC. They're putting out their own guidelines. They're doing all the things that RFK and the federal government has canceled in terms of healthcare, in terms of what the federal government supplied, in terms of recommendations and guidelines and those kind of things. So it goes back to what Nancy was talking about earlier, that sort of innovation in American culture, that Americans are willing to sort of sidestep guidelines and practices and do it themselves if they have to.
Well, and that makes me think, of course, of the ways we're trying to respond to what many of us are seeing as a rise in authoritarianism in the country. And it's hard to know exactly what to do as you watch things like the CDC and the NIH be destroyed, as we have our federal agencies dozed. It's like, what is my responsibility? I'm a citizen. How do I respond to that? And I think we've seen incredible creativity around that. The No Kings protests were, you know, some of the highlights of what I was writing my Christmas card for 2025, one of my highlights of the year, because it was a moment when I could come together with others. We could talk about what was happening in our own communities and in other communities, and the creation of this nationwide network so that you could have millions of people, you know, all protesting on the same day. And that gives you a great sense of strength. It hasn't changed what's happening in Washington, D.C. for us, but I think it's really important that we are in conversation, that these networks are being created. And then you have Indivisible, of course, is another organization that's a nationwide. We have an Indivisible Vashon. Again, really important sort of place for people to come together and talk about what are the strategies, what are our concerns, what are our hopes, and most importantly, what are the actions that we can take that feel at the moment like the best thing that we can do, the strongest thing we can do, and that we know who we can continue to talk with and organize with as we move forward, as Bruce mentioned earlier, towards those elections that will inevitably come our way.
In just a few months, November will be an interesting time, and that starts to approach the end of our time with Vashon 250, but I think we'll have lots to talk about and how history applies to all that, so it'll be interesting. With that, we need to talk about Vashon and how all of this relates to our local community.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're talking about Valley Forge as sort of a low point and how out of it we develop an innovative response. Washington rebuilds the Continental Army and really begins to move to a series of victories. You know, Saratoga has occurred. France enters the war, which we'll talk about over the next couple episodes. And so it really is, in many ways, a turning point and a low point at the same time. I think for Vashon, Vashon hasn't had a lot of low points, but it has had some. And I've always reminded and have to remind myself to think about the Chuabopsh people of Vashon Island. I mean, in 1854, we estimate the population of the Chuabopsh at about 12,000 pre-contact. By 1854, there are 30 left. So 99.9% are killed by diseases introduced by Europeans. And in 1854, the territorial government moves the Chuabopsh off of Vashon Island onto Fox Island, and then moves them to the Puyallup Reservation, and they become part of the Puyallup tribe. You know, that's a real low point. But if you look at the context of where the Puyallup tribe is today and the Chuabopsh people who are members of the Puyallup tribe, it's a story of resilience. It's a story of success. It's a story of growth. And right now, in the 2020s, the Puyallup tribe is a powerful economic engine in the Tacoma area. And so from 54 people to a very vibrant tribe today has been a tremendous sort of change.
Do we know if there are, heirs of the tribe still around?
Oh, yes. Yeah, right. There's quite a few members of the Puyallup tribe who trace back to families. Chuabopsh families, okay. Yes, right, yeah. And a few on the Nisqually and a few on the Muckleshoot, but primarily Puyallup. You also have the ferry strikes, and we've talked about this before in the 1930s and 1940s, that Vashon just gets so tired of it, they just say the hell with you, and we're going to form our own ferry district. And they form their own ferry district and for almost 4 years run their own ferries. Not particularly efficiently, but they run their own ferries until the Washington State Ferry system is formed. And also, just the disruptions. Vashon has always responded to disruptions of ferry service, with the Mosquito Fleet. Nels Christensen, who lived at Christensen Creek and Liza Beulah, was so upset with ferry service that he formed his own ferry system. He created the Virginia boats and ran his own ferries. The hell with you, I'll do it myself, kind of thing. In the 1980s, the Fauntleroy Dock was threatened with closure. And Seattle just, Vashon joined together and created, a ferry committee to fight that. The push for a passenger-only ferry to get more reliable access to Seattle. And then the Ferry Alliance, and right now today, the Vashon Alliance or the Vashon Islanders for Ferry Action are examples of how citizens on Vashon are trying to pressure the state to provide more reliable ferry service. So, yeah, Vashon has had its nadirs.
Great. And with that, thank you for joining us, as always. We hope you'll tune in again next time for more continuing adventures in American history.
That's a wrap to this episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us again each week through the end of 2026 for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island history. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic we might want to cover, please drop an email to vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a production of Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum. Our producer is Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services for business credit departments across the nation. For more information, go to nacmbcs.org. We appreciate their support. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.